Hi, good morning world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Tragedy and Hope. It's been such a long time since Richard Grove was on the show. But he hasn't just been sitting idly by. He's been very, very busy working. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Maria.
It's been a long time. What seems like a long time.
It seems like a long time, but when I think about like how much work I've gotten done in that time, it doesn't seem that long. It seems like just a couple projects ago. Not even big projects.
All right. Well, welcome back. You've been missed, sorely missed. You know, I'm looking at some of the posts and things on social media, and I have to tell you, the first thing I think about is all your work on critical thinking, because there's a lot of memes going around blaming Obama for not showing up during Katrina. And I said, wow, how stupid are people? Obama wasn't even president during Katrina. I mean, the level of ignorance that's out there, besides, you know, a lot of false news and fake posts, et cetera, it's astounding to me, Richard.
Well, I think some of those fake news memes, like blaming Obama for Katrina or giving a common today phrase attribution to Abraham Lincoln, I think that's just like an idiot test to see, not even that the person's an idiot overall. It's just that the nature of social media makes it such that we want to share things before we really consume and digest and think about them and figure out where they're going and where they're coming from historically. And it can happen to any of us at any given time. So, you know, when those things go around, you're just seeing, oh, it's not that me or you or James Corbett or whoever's tweeting, you know, is an idiot. It's just that, you know, you end up passing around something that you haven't really, you know, totally thought about. You might have strong feelings about Katrina and people getting left there by Bush and Mike Brown, who was like a horse connoisseur. He was a racehorse specialist, and he ends up in charge of FEMA back then. So facts aside, there was still a tragedy that went on, and then they add the wrong facts to it, and then it gets passed around. And then I think that does a disservice to the memory of that event as a learning experience for everybody about self-reliance versus waiting for the government to save you and these sort of things.
All right. Well, you know, for the past several days, I've been watching on YouTube a lot of the live rescues in Texas. And the majority of the people that are getting it done are just regular people. It's not the politicians. It's not the government. You know, thousands of Americans showed up. You know, everybody, I've seen great videos of, you know, people lined up with their cars, towing their boats in from other states. And, you know, you look at that and you see, you know, it goes back to my original question I've been asking for 20 years. What do we need government for? Especially the federal government. And here we sit, you know, while Americans are doing the right thing, I'm already thinking about the horrors that they're going to face because I covered Katrina every day that was happening. And then the disappointment when the government doesn't help them or leaves them in, you know, mold infested trailers for years. And what I'm reading is most of the people hit the hardest in Houston don't have insurance. So I think it's going to get pretty ugly, especially since we don't have anyone, you know, nominated to lead FEMA. Well, let's not leave that out. That's another empty chair in Trump's campaign. So it's a real mess, you know, and this morning they say it backed up and it's hitting Louisiana. So, you know, kind of makes you wonder about weather manipulation too.
Well, there is unfortunately a lot of valid research out there, where government, has taken tax dollars and put it into that. And if you just search weather modification plus Smithsonian, you'll see tons of Smithsonian technical papers over the past 50 or 60 years where they've been looking into doing this. I haven't seen any evidence that that was done in this specific case. I mean, it's well known that through the history of human beings, we have been here during natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, volcanic eruptions, all these sort of things happen from time to time and have a proclivity to hit certain places. So I think it really comes back to the mentality of self-reliance and being prepared. And even if you're watching what's going on in Houston and you don't live anywhere near a floodplain, there's still a type of natural disaster that could strike you. And maybe now is a good time to go through. And I don't think it's a bad idea for people to just have food and water for
right.
6 or 8 weeks, because various discontinuities of the distribution chain have been known to happen over time. And, you know, where I grew up, there was still a strong sense of the the Great Depression and the mentality of my grandparents being very, not only like thrifty, but growing their food on the land, canning and putting things in jars, making a lot of stuff that, so that you can survive the winter, and you always have like a stockpile of food that you grew, and you're, you know, that self-reliance goes up during a time when you don't have access to the grocery store. And I think a lot of those mannerisms became outdated because of our culture saying it's not cool to be self-reliant anymore. It's not cool to actually grow food on your property. Geez, let's spray poison all over your lawns to make it all perfectly green, and you're going to try to keep up with the Joneses, like poisoning the most valuable asset you have, which would be a piece of, you know, outside of your life, a piece of real estate where you could actually grow your own food and be self-reliant. And,
right.
And without that, there is a growing inclination to be dependent on government and the welfare state. And the thing about the welfare state is it doesn't just take care of poor people. It takes care of people on a wide variety of scales and spectrums, because otherwise you wouldn't have big corporations and these other groups supporting the welfare state. They get welfare too, right? So there's a broad spectrum, and it's not just all about taking care of poor people. And in the past, prior to America's engagement in the welfare state, you had a lot of private charities. And it feels good when you take a little bit extra of what you earned and you give it to other people who are in need. But instead, the government says, oh, we're going to take that for you because we could spend it better for you. And then you're missing out on the experience, and, you know, it's a human experience of helping somebody else in need. So you're not left with anything to give to these charities, the charities that were, you know, really helpful to people, especially during the Great Depression. Those weren't necessarily not existing at that time, because there had been a smaller recession or depression in like 1920 or 21 that kind of rectified itself. So it wasn't the first time that people all of a sudden lived in a city and needed food, and, you know, these things weren't being made available. But because of the mentality that the government is going to come in and rescue you, I think that's, I don't know, it's like inviting a burglar in because you know the police are going to come and take care of it afterwards. Like, they're going to show up later, they're going to file a report, right? Maybe you get your stolen goods back, maybe not. So it's like there's two pieces of the mentality. And I think one piece of the mentality is securing your own property to be able to be self-reliant, you know, and without that mentality. So you're left with all these people down in the Houston area that somebody's watching the news around them, likely, or they should be told maybe by their local government. If you're going to have a local government, one of the purposes should be to, like, help you survive and not drown. And these people were left with, well, I'll just wait for someone to tell me. They're not saying to evacuate, so I shouldn't evacuate. And it's a horrific, horrific situation that doesn't need to occur, but it's going to continue to occur until we figure out a better way to handle these situations. And I think handling it as individuals, we could all be a little bit more self-reliant and a little bit therefore less dependent on the government or FEMA or whoever to come in and save you. Because you're right. We were talking a little bit before the show. Most of the people you see down there saving other people aren't just people that are working for government. They're not just police or rescue or fire people. They're people that are just trying to help their neighbors. Or they're people who live in another area that's safe from the storm and have the resources and manpower to go down and save some lives. And so, you know, it's not something that we're never going to see something like this again. We did just see it like back in 2004, 2005, back in the time of Katrina. So these things happen several times during our lifetime, just in the realm of storms, not even natural disasters, earthquakes, things like that, just in the realm of storms. So there's a lot more that I think people can do to have a mentality of, if you live someplace that might flood, don't live so close to the water, live uphill a little bit. And, you know, but we're all born into this world. We don't get to choose where we're born. And we grow up into a system that's pre-existing, and they don't go through a lot of trouble to teach us about any of this stuff. So again, it falls back to, if you think for yourself to start learning about these things, it has an advantage survival-wise, especially, but it's not being advertised to us. And then you have to ask, why? Wouldn't they want people to be able to think and thrive and survive?
Right. Well, what I find interesting is during Hurricane Sandy, which, as you remember, hit the East Coast, a lot of these very same Republicans that are now asking for federal aid for Texas voted against aid for Sandy. Even Mike Pence read it from the Bible at the time, basically saying it's God's will. But Texas also wanted to secede from the Union. So now you got to look at it and say, well, will this change their thinking? Will this change their hatred, their hateful laws against gays, against, you know, the bathroom laws, you know, their racism? Will this unite the people, or do you think it's just a temporary unity?
Well, usually, historically, with these types of disasters, it's probably a temporary unity that has a lingering effect of camaraderie and friendship, and maybe ameliorative relations between groups that otherwise wouldn't have interacted with each other. You know, because if you have a neighbor next door of a different race, religion, ethnicity, whatever you want to say, different, they're different than you, and you don't talk to them, but during the flood, you guys found a way to survive together, you're probably still going to be friends after that flood. And if you both got screwed over by big government that you never approved of, you're probably both going to have that opinion afterwards, right? So now you got something in common. So there was a lot of people that are helping people, like just back in during the time of 9/11. Think about how everyone just came together and everyone stopped arguing for a couple minutes or a couple days or whatever. Right. And so, but there can be long lasting relationships built out of that. So, the other point, when you brought up Sandy, that just made me think of like the new insurance laws that went into effect that said all these houses on the coast had to be up on stilts. And in order to renovate a house, you had to raise the house and the insurance is jacked up. And then, so that's one side that some of these groups are profiting in a monopolistic fashion after these natural disasters. But then I thought, what happens right, you know, before that all goes into effect 6 months or 2 years later, what happens right afterwards? Well, all these people that couldn't afford insurance in these low-lying areas that could flood it out, therefore can't afford to fix it. Therefore, their property becomes valueless, which then it gets scooped up by these other guys who want to redevelop it. And then they're going to jack up the insurance on that. So now it becomes an area away. I mean, it's a natural phenomenon. It's a natural disaster because we don't have any evidence to the contrary yet. So it's a natural disaster, but still government has figured out a way to give certain groups in the cartel capitalist sector to prosper from that destruction in such a way that it redistributes populations. So I'm not saying that's an intentional causal relationship, but it is a causal and not corollary relationship.
Right. Well, all you have to do is look at Louisiana after Katrina to see the same thing. Before Katrina, their whole board or council was black. After Katrina, it was all white. It was the black neighborhoods that suffered the worst. They say this storm is hitting, of course, in the poorest neighborhoods, as usual. And, you know, there's a pattern here. It's the same pattern as putting all these oil refineries and chemical plants and nuclear power plants in the neighborhoods of the poorer people. You know, I was reading this morning how toxic the air is in Houston. You know, my own granddaughter called me yesterday, and she was telling me she wanted to go. She was going to be on her way, like, next week to Houston to try to help out. And I said, you're not going to Houston. I said, it's as toxic as 9/11 except for the explosives. And, you know, most people are not thinking about that, but the air is going to be super toxic. God knows what's floating in that water, let alone all those rotting buildings underwater. I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing to volunteer, but it's also reminded me of 9/11 when Christy Whitman said, you know, come back to New York. The air is clean. 3 days later, you know that was a lie.
Well, and think about the mentality that gets people suckered into going in and cleaning up toxic environmental waste areas under the guise of, you know, you need to do this to help your fellow human beings. Right.
Right.
Because there, definitely in the case of 9/11 first responders, there was evidence, heavy evidence, that they needed much more protection to work in that area than they were being told they needed or were provided for or any of these things. And not all the people that were working on the pile were people that got paid to be there. There are people that volunteered, that drove with their construction companies from all over the country trying to help out and get, you know, get that place cleaned up. Why did it have to be cleaned up so fast? Oh, because somebody else had plans to build a building and make a whole bunch of money on that property. Which, if you're going to do anything with ground zero, I thought it should be a no trade area. No commercial business whatsoever. That would make a real statement in downtown Manhattan. Right down the street from Wall Street. There's a place that you can't do any monetary trading, or, you know, you can't have these big banks and whatnot. But no, they just built another tower and did their thing.
Probably they took one of their goals all along. You know, listen, when all these things happen, the question people still have to ask is who benefits? Because to me, when this storm, where, you know, people are sending me videos of how this could have been man-made or, you know, whatever. But I said, you know what, it's going to take days before we figure out who benefits. It might take months to figure out who benefits, if that was the case. And it was the same thing with 9/11. And, you know, it's like every election, Rich. You know, we may not know who's going to win, but we always know who the losers are, and it's we the people.
Well, I think that's because people engage in activities without really thinking about what they're doing. I used to engage in voting. I did it from the time I was allowed to vote, and I was like, this is great. And I did it last in 2004. And so I started out voting for my first vote, I believe, was for George H.W. Bush because I didn't know any better. And I don't think I voted in the Clinton election because I didn't like how, like, once you vote, then you start watching what goes on. I was like, I don't think I like either of these guys. And then in 2000, I was living someplace, and I had registered to vote. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll vote. And I voted for George W. Bush, and then I was like, wow, that didn't work out too well. So in 2004, I was watching, they had, you might have heard of this, a third party. They had a third party represented, and instead of just the Republican Democrat, I heard somebody who was a college professor, I think in Texas someplace at a university, and he was talking about these ideas of freedom and self-ownership and non-aggression and some of these other ideas. Like, who's this guy? His name is Michael Badnarik, and he was the Libertarian candidate for president. So I was like, okay, I'm going to vote Libertarian. And that was 2004. And after that, I stopped voting because I was like, what am I voting for? I'm voting to give people rights. I'm voting to give a group rights that I don't have personally. And I don't like a lot of what they're doing with those, that group rights that they call government. They're waging unnecessary non-defensive wars, i.e. wars of aggression. They put non-violent criminals in cages for super-duper double life sentences. And there's all this sort of stuff. And it's like every time you vote or, you know, you pay taxes, when you pay taxes under the threat of going to a cage. So a lot of people pay taxes. But as far as voting, they're not going to put me in a cage yet for not voting. So that's one place where I could still be like, you know what? More than half of this country didn't participate in this past presidential election. And that's not because those people were all illiterate and ignorant of the political process, right? Some of those people believe that voting itself in that context of a national election to give a president power to have nuclear weapons might not be such a good idea for a group as large as 350 million people.
Right. Well, I also think that a lot of people know that their votes don't count. You know, the Electoral College proved it, you know, again this year. The popular vote didn't matter. Same as with Kerry, Al Gore. You know, and remember, you know, with Bush, the Supreme Court put him in power.
Sure.
So I'd like to think that out of the, you know, 50% that doesn't vote, maybe, I hope, maybe 25% of them do it because they know their vote doesn't count.
Literally, like when I looked up about the Electoral College of Connecticut, I was like, who are all these people? They're the people who actually vote for president. And who picks them? Pretty much the governor or whoever, whatever the political party is in power. They don't know you. They don't care about you. They're not trying to answer your questions or represent you. And so that's where I think it gives legitimacy to a bull crap system when you go ahead and participate and be like, no, I'm going to cast my vote for this guy. It's like, wait a minute. The lesser of two evils, or even three evils, is still evil, right? So when you're legitimizing a group that goes around, I'm not saying that government has no positive function or any of those sort of things, which may or may not be true. I'm just saying, as of recently, when you look at how much money they're spending and charging us and our kids and our grandkids in debt, right? When you look at that, and then look at how cavalierly they handle these trillions of dollars that they lose all over the place. And that was one of the examples I used in my recent episode was, here's $9 trillion missing. Here's $12 trillion missing. It's like there's more missing trillions than we even owe in our national debt. So you know they're going to add that stuff later at some point when nobody's looking. So there's all these different layers. You could call them tethers that we didn't voluntarily agree to. And it's something that as a conscious human being, when you start examining the systems and the way that, you know, the instruments of government, the institutions, how all these things came about, what their real purpose is, how they impact your life. These are all things we're not taught about in school. So to do them through a form of self-study, I think, is very important. And instead of like waiting for people to randomly like just do that for themselves, I try to provide them with a little structure modeled on how I'm doing it for myself. Right. So you can't look at TV or you can't look at any one channel and see what's going on. You can't even look at like Fox, CNN, MSNBC, look at them all. I think you should, because you want to see the opposing views. That's where you get the comparison and contrast to understand. But I don't even think you're getting the full spectrum there. And that's where the internet really has changed things. And especially since disasters like Katrina, now you've got social media, social networks, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, things like this, where people have immediate access to voice themselves in public. Whereas before you would have had to write a letter to the editor of the newspaper and beg. Or call the TV station and hope that they would give you a 5-minute time slot to discuss your social issue, right? Now everybody, now everybody has a voice out there. So that's one of the positive aspects of the internet. And if they're going to use it to surveil us, at least we should be using it to
stop and kill them, as we used to say in the 60s.
Right.
So, you know, I have two great examples of that. This week was this nursing home in Texas where the son of the owner took a picture of the old ladies all sitting in a waiting room, half submerged in water. Within 15 minutes of that going crazy on social media, rescue showed up. They had not even gotten a return call from rescue. And then, of course, I'm sure you saw what happened with Joel Osteen, who, you know, the multimillionaire, you know, fake preacher under the tent, didn't want to open up his church for relief victims. And then the pressure was on online. I mean, people ripped him to shreds. And then, you know, within hours, those doors were open. So it is a good tool for some activism, for sure.
Well, and I think that, you know, because you want to think through both sides before you apply pressure on social media, right? So let's think it through. Joel Osteen, he's a very popular televangelist who has a huge congregation down in the Houston area. So maybe he doesn't want his church to get all messed up with all these flood victims who obviously, you know, they're going to not be in a clean situation. Are there shower facilities at this place? You might go through these questions. But then you learn, oh, he bought the old Houston Rockets arena. What a great place to house people. It's probably got all these areas outside of that seating area, concourses, they call them, that would have bathrooms and fresh water and maybe even have some sort of food that they could serve these people. Now, you know, if you take some of these seats off the floor, you could probably put up little cubicle areas and give people beds, right? So instead of like getting that far with his thinking, the first thing I think he did was he put up a link on his site to support the flood victims, which is a direct donation to him.
All right. So it's like asking for a $50 minimum donation.
Well, and if he had a plan of action where he was actually going to implement, you know, take that money that his congregate, that's the purpose of a congregation in that part of like, that arena of event. The reason you have that congregation who might not be adversely affected and be able to help is to actually help, not to just like juice your congregation and not help the people that, you know, are flood victims. So that's a place where social media was used as a lever. And when you have a long lever, you can make a lot of things move. I think it was Archimedes.
Well, you know, I've always said it shows me the pulse of America when I sign on there, especially if you go on during a live speech by Trump and you're watching the chat room. And, I mean, some of what you read is absolutely shocking. That's all I can say. I'm like, oh, my God. So here we are at a point that you don't remember because I know you're way younger than me. But it seems like we're having a total redo of the 60s, especially with the, I'm going to call them, you know, Nazis versus America. You could call them race riots. You can call them whatever you want. Why do you think this is happening now? I mean, separate of the fact that Trump encouraged it every day of his campaign.
I know this is a bold thought that no one's ever thought of on this show, but I think that the education system of America got corrupted. I think along with it, the media cartel became a lot closer with the military, industrial, congressional apparatus. And as a function of that, people became more and more inclined to be dependent on the state, which allows the state to take your freedom and add to its power, right? So that's the whole dynamic that's been growing. So given that environment, it's not surprising to see a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos, especially when you can just throw a little extra money at a couple of these sides and you can have more chaos. You can have more chaos by telling the mayor, hey, maybe have the police stand down in Charlottesville, right? You can add to the chaos just with the unknown that probably, I don't know if it was planned, but that guy that comes in and drives over people, I think that's like something that kicks off from that other situation that might have been sculpted, right? That may or may not have been planned. And if it wasn't planned, that guy was inspired spontaneously from that situation to do that to other human beings.
Right.
So that creates even more chaos. So then, you know, things get out of control and nobody who maybe has an objective third party, not interested, don't have a dog in this fight view, really gets to talk to anybody. And so they stay polarized. They get even more polarized. Right. Because wasn't it, was it the Blues Brothers where they had the Nazis marching like in Chicago or something like that? Which I believe that was, it was based on,
yeah.
There was a real event and then it was mimed in the movie, if memory serves. Right?
Yeah.
And they like splash mud on them or something, right? So those dudes had a right to march because freedom of speech. And if nobody goes and protests, nothing really happens. What happens is when you get these guys and they're going to have a march and then you add, hey, theatrical, let's give them some torches, right?
Right.
That's Nazis. That's the KKK. There's a lot of imagery going on there. And then it's like, hey, let's bust a bunch of people in who hate these guys, right? Now you're going to have a polarized standoff. And then the mayor says, hey, police, you guys don't break that up. And there is a policeman that I saw a quote from where he's like, hey, they knew ahead of time that they were creating this situation. And then it just took off, right? And so could that happen spontaneously? If it could happen spontaneously, why do they have to plan it? That's the question. So,
well, yeah, then you have to go to how do they benefit?
Okay, so it benefits just by creating chaos because some people benefit from the chaos. So in Houston with the flooding, with the hurricane, you're going to have real estate arbitrage going on, people going in and gobbling up these undervalued assets before everybody else kind of, you know, realizes what's going on. And then they'll sell them to some other people and they'll bundle them up and sell them to some bank. And then they'll loan out money to develop that area and it'll all be a new area, right? So knowing that pattern, we have to look at the fact that why are those people living in that low income area? Oh, because that's low property value. Why is it low property value? Probably because it has a likelihood of flooding or it has corporate pollution because of what used to be there, right? So then you have to take into consideration, it's like, well, how do these people get poor in the first place? Oh, the education system didn't tell them how to be self-reliant. So they've always thought that in order to survive, they have to get a job. And if you raise the minimum wage too high, you're taking jobs away from people because now less people can be, you know, getting a job because of the money that they might be earning from a job is below the minimum wage. And then you have these other situations where they come in and say, we're going to say you're penalized as an employer. If your employee works 40 hours a week, you got to pay into this cartel healthcare system. So what do they do? They take all those jobs, they split them in half. Now everyone works 20 hours a week, twice as many jobs, makes it look like the jobs are going up.
Right. But meanwhile, no one has health insurance, no one can't pay their bills, but they don't really care.
Right.
So, you know, the new paradigm is if you're born poor in America, you're going to stay that way.
Well, and that's the paradigm they want for everybody because as they automate society with robots and drones and all these other things, they're taking jobs away, and they're not inspiring or teaching people how to create new products and services, right? So there's a stifling of creative innovation, entrepreneurial skill sets to be self-reliant and autonomous, and it's being replaced with the government's going to guarantee you a salary. The government's going to pay for your health care. The government's going to pay for your education. The government, whatever. Well, all those things that you think you're getting for free, you're assigning them control. It's not just like free. And first off, government doesn't create anything, so it has to take what it has from somebody else. So government is the definition of wealth redistribution. So people who want wealth redistribution, it's already going on. That's what the government does. So there's these things that, I don't know, I find them interesting because it's an ongoing dynamic and we're all in the middle of it. And I haven't seen a really coherent explanation of it all yet.
Right. Well, I guess we'll have to, you know, keep watching the storm and see what's going on there. But, you know, to me, it's like all of a sudden now we've got Nazis in America. Now this is the Nazis versus Antifa, you know, another thing I never heard of before. And I'm sure there's plenty of paid provocateurs in those crowds. And I did see a couple of people that went to protest against the Nazis who were creative about it. Some of them, the whole group just dressed like clowns. So, you know, the artistic part of Americans comes out, which I think is more effective than, you know, showing up with guns and tear gas.
Well, I think step one is let's all just take a step back and take all these labels off our mind for a minute. I believe in freedom. I believe I own my own body. I believe that I have a right to private property. Otherwise, I can't be self-reliant. I would fully be reliant on the government. Being fully reliant on the government means I'm a slave and I have no control. So that's kind of where I stand on it, personally. As far as Antifa and the neo-Nazis, first off, we've had Nazis in this country for a long time because Bush and these guys, their family funded the Nazis. A lot of the eugenics ideas that they espouse came from the Eastern establishment elite, aka your deep state or shadow government, right? So these ideas have existed for a long time. Why is it a big deal today? Well, Nazism is literally a form of national socialism. That's what the Nazis were, right? So you've got Nazis out there. They're marching around. You got to oppose that, right? You got to fight Nazis. Okay, what are you going to do? We're going to do Antifa, which is the party that opposed the Nazis in Germany in the 30s, and the anti-fascists were communists. And communism is international socialism. So really what you're looking at is the two ends of the vise that they're using to squeeze the public and squeeze your freedoms out is international socialism on the side of Antifa. Those are the anarcho-communists. And on the other side, you've got national socialism. That's the so-called alt-right. Okay. And in between is everybody that kind of believes in freedom and leave me aloneism. Like, you know, do what you want to do. Just don't infringe on my freedom. And I don't have the ability to put you in a cage. So don't vote for somebody to put me in a cage. Right. So there's these notions, but we're not taught. These are very simple things you could learn like a kindergarten level. But obviously, since the government controls our education and indoctrinates us through 15,000 hours of these classes, we're not provided those views, which are very easy to understand if you take the labels off and say, wait a minute, let's just look at it from freedom and slavery. Freedom's good, slavery not so good. Slavery's bad. Right. Slavery's unethical. Using violence, you know, to aggress, to initiate violence, is unethical. There is never an ethical motive or motion to do that. And yet today, it's like, if you punch a Nazi, it's okay. Well, then it starts to, like, you know, morph into, you got these two sides. One traditionally wore cloaks and hoods of one color, and the ones on the other side, the black bloc, they're dressed in one color and cover their heads too. And when you look at the history, it's like there's destruction on both sides. So it's like, should you vote for one of those two evils, Maria? Or should you maybe say, you know what, I'm just backing away slowly and I'm keeping my eyes on this.
Right. Well, Italians have an expression. They say, fate, fate, do, which translates into mind your own business. Rich, we're going to take a short break. Stay with us. Rich and I will be right back. Okay, welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with one of the smartest people I know on the planet, Richard Grove. If you're not familiar with his work, get over to tragedyandhope.com. Rich, I know you just finished a huge educational piece, 40 hours worth. Where can people access that?
Well, by the time you hear this, I should have it up on tragedyandhope.com. And otherwise, you could just search for Peace Revolution 93, and it would pop up on the the hosting platforms I use for the podcast. What I've been doing the last 24 hours is building a podcast-specific landing page. So when I post an episode, it's got all the links you need, the player, all the stuff, very nice, neat, organized, works on a mobile phone, formatted very nicely, instead of what I'm getting from my podcast hosting, because both sites, I'm not, you know, one site, the links aren't working, the other site, the player's not working. So I said, that's going to be a better way. I'm going to build a custom page template that I can just plug this stuff into. And so from now on, I'll be posting it mainly on tragedyandhope.com.
Great, great. Okay, when we were talking about labels and the Antifa versus the Nazis, and that, it, you know, is it right to punch a Nazi in the face? Well, somebody will say, well, is it right to run a woman down with your car? But how about the attacks on Muslims in this country? It's not like the Muslims are punching anybody in the face. You know, these Muslim women, I'm sure you saw that story about the women in New York on the train. I believe it was New York.
I didn't see that story. So what was it? What happened?
Well, they were just wearing their hijabs on the train, and some wacko, you know, white nut job attacked them. And two men got up to help the women, and he killed one of the two men. You know, there's so many of these incidents, you know, attacks on synagogues, attached on, you know, temples for, you know, Jewish people. You know, it was funny because I was looking, not funny, haha, but I was looking at the Israeli Times this morning. And when they covered the flood in Houston, all they said was that it heavily affected the Jewish community in Houston.
Mm.
Everybody just picks and chooses. You know, it's like that attack in Barcelona last week. You know, oh, there was one American killed. You know, what is it that people have such tunnel vision and don't realize that we're all in this together?
Well, I think number one, the tunnel vision comes from the emotional reaction and not the thoughtful response. And media drives the emotional reaction. And emotions are how we think or how we feel about what we think. And if what we think is being corrupted through media and education, then that's directly manipulating how people feel and react instead of think and respond. So
Right. Any
of these things, you know, violence against any of these groups, first off, the non-aggression principle, which is not a starting point, but it's a corollary of objective reality. It says that if you're around other people, you're probably going to prosper more if you don't prey and plunder and initiate violence against them. It's going to lead to a more efficient and effective life for you by not trying to always look over your shoulder to see if the person you just stole from or killed or their family member is coming after you or whatever, right? So it's just a logical tenet that spawns from an axiom that things exist and there's cause and effect and we're conscious of it. And here we are. How do we act in the world around other human beings? Non-aggression is a great principle. But when it comes to nation states, unfortunately, we got this big budget that has to grow every year, and in order to spend all that money, they have to drop bombs on people on the other side of the world, right? Who may or may not have had something to do with something that happened here one time, once upon a time, whatever. But what it does is actively grow people that hate this place and are willing to blow themselves up, which I think is tragic all around. I don't think America's perfect, but I think there's some good potential here if we, like, you know, brush off some of this rust and do some restoration of principles of liberty that apply to individuals, because that's what we all care about. Our freedom, our liberty, our ability to be able to express ourselves. And the limitation on freedom is that it doesn't take away somebody else's freedom. So as that goes, that's pretty good as the history of human beings go. That's a lot more freedom than a lot of people had through history. A lot of people had miserable, tragic lives, and that was the normal. That's what you could, that's the best you could hope for a lot of these populations. So
Right. It's
first, let's take stock and appreciate all the great things that we have as a function of what we have before we try to tear everything down. But at the same time, let's learn about these principles in a conscious sense and then say, what is practically, you know, what can we actually do to practically enable some of these ideas of freedom and push back against some of the items that are on the slavery list? Because when they're manipulating your emotions as a function of you just going through life thinking you're being informed and really you're being manipulated by entities you haven't had time to learn about, I think that's tragic. But the flip side, the hope of that is that you could actually bump into some truth, start to think for yourself, question some of these things, question obedience, question authority maybe, do the historical research on it. So I found it fascinating, for instance, that the Antifa flag that they use as their logo today comes directly from the communist flag that was used for Antifa in Germany back in the 30s. So it's not even like new when people were like, oh, Antifa. It's like, no, it's new that they're using black bloc tactics and this sort of thing. But the idea of Antifa to be anti-fascist, that was anti-national socialism, but the anti wasn't capitalism and free market. The anti was international communism or international socialism, which is communism.
Right. Well, you know, I think about the lack of education has to be a part of the overt racism that we've seen in this country, more so since Trump took office. And when I look at that, you know, recently I watched a 16-hour series on New York, which you'd probably love, Rich, because I know, you know, you've worked there and lived there. And, you know, in New York, when you had people coming in, you know, in the 1700s, the 1800s, 1900s, they were people from almost every country on earth. And even though they thought New York City couldn't handle having so many different ethnicities, languages, et cetera, what they found was that people got along because they had to. So New York was really the creation of the expression, the melting pot. And they talked about how each nationality or group brought in skills that were missing, and that they were surprised by how well all these different cultures managed to get along in a city like New York. And that was something I never knew, that New York was really, you know, I always knew it was the Empire State, never really thought about why. But it led the country in so many ways, and a lot of the rest of the country was totally against New York. Because of that fact. So, you know, racism, I guess, depends on where you live, where you're born. Like you said, we don't pick where we're born. Thank God I picked New York. But when you look at it, it's an old situation in this country. But when you're forced to deal with each other, you find that we have more in common than not, as they're finding out in Texas this week. You know, I'm watching white guys rescuing black people. I'm watching black people rescuing white people. And I was thinking to myself, if you're getting rescued by somebody, are you questioning whether they're gay? Are you questioning whether they're a Muslim? Are you questioning the color of their skin? Hell no, because everybody's in it together. I think it's a really good example, in a terrible way, that we are all in this together, and it's all of us versus the 1%. And still people don't know that.
Well, and I think that some of the connotations of the melting pot have been redefined in recent years. Because the melting pot used to be, there's people from all over the world coming into New York. They're bringing in their cultures and their language, and they're most likely living in an ethnic area, right? Because New York, in an urban environment, allows that. So you have a bunch of Italians in one place, you have a bunch of Poles living in another place. You have a bunch of other people that might have come over from Ireland in another place. And so a non-judgmental connotation where that was called, those were ghettos. Those were ghettos, people of a certain ethnicity that came over in a country. So are they totally assimilating? No. Are they totally giving up all their heritage and their language? No. It's preserved in those neighborhoods. But when they leave that neighborhood and go into Brooklyn or the Bronx, or they're working on a bridge, or they're building a skyscraper, guess what? They learned how to listen in English, to take instructions, and they learned how to, you know, get along without, you know, they weren't saying, you have to learn to speak my language, otherwise I'm not taking this job. It's like, no, if you want this job, you're going to need to learn, you know, how the rest of the people are communicating, and that just makes sense. And I don't think there was a big political issue, to my knowledge, about that. That's just how it is.
It also showed the stark contrast and inequality that's always been in this country. You know, it's not something new today.
Well, it's not even just this country, because that's always been through human history for the most part, because some people used methods of plunder and predation to accumulate the wealth of other people.
Right. Well, you know, I tend to refer to this country because we're in it.
Yeah. present day.
We're in it. But, you know, there's so much out there to learn And you know, earlier when you were talking about self-reliance, the other night I was flipping through, I don't know, which one of my, you know, TV things I watch. And I noticed there's a TV show, because I don't really watch too much television, called Preppers. And it's all about people that have spent pretty much most of their lives preparing for doomsday, growing their own food, raising their own fish, making tunnels under their house so they can escape when the government comes to get them.
A great example of taking a good idea too far.
That's what I started watching, and then it got so crazy, and within 10 minutes, it was off the charts nuts. And I said, okay, I'm done with this. And now listen, there are times you can't prepare. I mean, listen, a lot of those people in Houston, in, you know, other towns that were just totally wiped out, they were poor, okay? It's not like they had the safety of knowing they have 10 grand in the bank and they, wherever they go, they got a charge card that's going to work.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because they could have saved food and water all they wanted and then, you know, the waves came in. And when I looked at that, and I told my friends, because we live in a fire zone where I am, you know, it's every summer, it's like a nightmare. So here we're all used to knowing what we would put in a firebox, the important things to grab if you got 5 minutes to get out of your property. But I looked at a lot of those people on film and they were just walking out, some of them just in their pajamas. I mean, they're totally screwed. So they could have tried some planning, and then my other part of my brain says, but these people probably aren't making enough money to put any money in a savings account. Most Americans don't have more than $500 in case of an emergency.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. So first off,
I know. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on that.
No, I can cover it though. TV's like a funhouse mirror, so when you see those prepper shows, they're showing you people taking it to maybe an unhealthy extreme. There's a lot of other things you got to balance in life. But I do think that you should just recognize preparing for the unknown is a good thing. Don't do it too much, but it's like if you live in a place where you might have to pick up and leave, know where the important things are. If there's a fire, a flood, a hurricane, tornado, whatever might hit your area, think through that. That's all. The prepared mentality is another item. That's something you need to have with you all the time and use every day. So the mentality of doing it and doing it to a limited potential of whatever your estimate is, and then doing it full time as that's the only thing you do. That's why I'm saying that's a good idea taken to an extreme, and that's entertaining. That's why they put it on TV, because it's like a funhouse mirror lens. As far as people that are destitute and immobile and didn't have the chance or wherewithal to be able to get out of that zone. That, if government's going to perform some sort of good service for people using its tax dollars, it'd be great to know, hey, have the nursing homes and the hospitals and these other places, or how about these other people that we know are at home and they're immobilized, they're on home health care, have we checked on them, right? But that's not what they're thinking about. They're thinking about, if we tell people to evacuate, what's our legal liability? And then the lawyers, this is all lawyers do, they'll tell you some scary language, why you shouldn't take action and you should do this, and no action's better than taking action that brings about chaos and people getting hurt. But if you don't take any action, all these other people are going to get hurt along with it, and the government can just step back and then come in and be like, no, we're helping you, right? So in the real places where it could have helped, there are people like, oh, you know, we know it's going to rain 50 inches here, and it's going to sit over here for 5 days, and we know the effects of that. And we know that if we tell these two counties of 6.5 million people total to evacuate, it's going to be chaos. So let's just not say anything. That was a business decision in a conference room that was had by people who are your elected representatives in that area. I don't know.
Right.
So I tend to think that these type of disasters where we actually all start helping each other and actually being very human and open with each other and helping without government assistance, that's the free market. We would like to see more of that without having destruction as like the way we get there. But what happens with these destructive events is government comes in and says, oh, we're going to need more budget for next time to help this, you know. But obviously, the people who really needed help didn't get the help.
No,
this is a recurring thing.
They're not going to become the forgotten.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, the people after Katrina, they'll become the forgotten. And, you know, here we have, you know, a president who's got no one leading FEMA, you know, no one at least in the top job, who's wants to cut the budget for FEMA, wants to cut the budget for the Coast Guard, which has been working 24/7 since the storm happened. You know, you got Texas who doesn't like regulations, so they had no regulations in place. I'm like, how could people have a house and not be forced to have homeowners insurance? But I guess that's gone. They changed their, they've even changed the law as recently as last month to reduce the insurance company's liability, and they're saying that they may actually use it retroactively to the date that paper was signed. I think it was May 27th. So again, I keep telling people for so many decades I'm bored with it. The only thing I trust our government to do is kill us all.
Well, that's a real downer for the ending of the show, Maria. I don't know.
No, I'm not going to end it on
that's
that.
That's hard to pick it up. That's hard to pick it up from there.
If you think about on 9/11, how many times do you talk to people about 9/11 and they will insist, oh, our government would never kill its own people? You know, that kind of ignorance is dangerous.
It's also easy to cure. I can cure it with one Google search word.
Democide.
It means death by government. It was the greatest killer of human beings in the 20th century. 300 million individuals died. Not like from war. Death by their own governments. And it's a research study by a professor. I think it was made in the late 90s. It stands to this day as accurate. So democide. D-E-M-O-C-I-D-E. Learn about it. Because
all right.
I think that's something that we have the ability to say, oh, if a function of giving tax dollars to a government is that the government kills some of its people, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should figure out how to, like, have prosperity and progress that doesn't start with violence. That's a really good thing. I think, you know, one of the other things I wanted to mention is I just thought it was fascinating. Earlier, or actually it was last week, they decrypted this cuneiform tablet from Sumeria. So a Babylonian clay tablet where they used to press the little stylus into the clay. They've had this on exhibit in Columbia University since like the 1920s or 30s. They finally just decrypted what it is. And it's a trigonometric table that's more accurate than what we use today. And I was like, wow, people 3,500 years ago had a more accurate way to do trigonometry than we do today. Now, that's a small point, but it can have large ramifications. Consider that maybe we're not the smartest we've ever been in history, that there was a time prior to this when people were actually really, really smart, and that we've been kind of being dumbed down. But along with that dumbed down process, they've created us to, you know, and conditioned us to think we're the smartest generation or the smartest group of people ever. Say, wait a minute, actually look at this. And if we have been getting dumbed down, then we need to close that gap just to get back to where we were. And if you want to look for yourself, look at any documents from the 1700s, 1800s, on science and theology and these concepts. And I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but just look at the depth and detail of the described thoughts and then compare it to your Twitter feed.
Right. Or just compare the language skills used.
Right.
Now, there's so many times I want to share a meme, but there's so many misspells in it that I don't bother.
And if you want to control a population, you whittle down its language, because then it can't describe the freedom that it's losing. And you lower the number of words they're allowed to use in their communications by default, right? So if you want to use more words than whatever it is, 148 characters on Twitter, you got to put it in a picture and attach it. And that's how you can include more words. Or you could do separate tweets, right? So I'm just saying.
Well, you know, the whole thing is, like you and myself, I mean, I'm self-educated. I'm constantly learning. I'm constantly reading. I'm constantly studying. I want to know. And that's really what everybody needs to be doing.
Well, and so because of that good-natured intention, let's say that's a natural intention of learning because that leads to our own evolution as a human being. Let's say that that's the nature of things. Now you have government come along and say, oh, well, we can just bend that a little bit to go over here so that you'll learn the things that we want you to learn. And even if we're, you know, even if you're looking at the right and left in the political spectrum, you'll think that's the whole thing, when really they have to exclude a whole lot of ideas to whittle it down to this artificial scarcity where it's like lesser of two evils, right? And why would they have to do that if there weren't answers outside of those two that kind of probably make better sense? Why would they have to exclude them? They'd just say, here's a stupid idea, you know, and you'd know it's stupid.
Right.
So they keep freedom and the idea of freedom and slavery out of that whole connotation, because when you look at it on paper, it's like the Republican Party came about in the 1800s because they were abolitionists And the Democratic Party literally was founded by the people who supported slavery. And the guy who set it up, Augustus Belmont, was the bag man for the Rothschilds in America. So it was totally bankers on the side of the Confederacy that started the Democratic Party. But then, like, in the 50s and 60s, it went through a rebranding where they're like, no, they're the party of the people and all that sort of stuff. But in either case, the essence of both parties, I think it's a long way off today than where it's either party started. So.
All right. Well, Rich, thanks so much for joining me today. We'll have to do this again a whole lot sooner.
Thank you so much, Maria, and thank you to all of you listening. It's a pleasure to take this hour out of my day and opine on such events and hopefully add some value to your perspective, or at least inspire
Always.
You to grow in the right direction.
Always. Thanks, Rich. We'll talk soon.
All right. Have a great dinner.